morning.
How are you doing?
Hey, Grace. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Morning.
Morning.
Good to be meeting again. It's been a long time. Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks.
Yes. Are you feeling better? You said that you were sick around the past, Easter?
Yes, I had a cold for 3 weeks, and I am doing better. Thank you very much.
I can't believe it was snowing this morning.
I know, it's still snowing.
Yeah, here it's not. At least where I am, which is probably not very far from where you are. But
all right. Good morning, everyone. I believe we left off at saying number 7.
Yep.
It's a doozy, saying 7. And I don't think we actually talked about it. So why don't we jump right in to saying number 7. And then we'll do what we do, read it, have a moment of silence to let the introverts catch up and have a thought or two. And then we'll start our discussion. I'll begin with saying number 7. Yeshua said, "Fortunate is the lion eaten by a human, for lion becomes human. Unfortunate is the human eaten by a lion, for human becomes lion." Let's let that marinate for just a moment in quiet. What do you think about saying number 7?
Well, is it something inner that we're supposed to be thinking about? I'm trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you guys, does anyone have a thought about it?
As being the libido in the life force within us.
Okay, Jeanette, I want to remind you, you need to look at your microphone while you speak, and then we can hear you.
Okay. The book I'm reading that you recommended said that the lion is like your libido, that you need to, the life force within us, and eating it means to tame it and master it, which we need to.
What do you guys think about the idea of mastery and whether we master our urges and the ego and other things, or if they master us? What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think we certainly have.
Okay, I heard about half of what you said, Jeanette.
I said, I think we need to master them. Yes, and control them.
Okay. Jeanette, I don't know if this is helpful at all, but when you're speaking, your mouth is underneath your camera. And if you have in any way a system that is looking at your mouth and moving to start kicking your microphone in, this might be part of the problem.
The other thing I could try is.
Ah! We heard more.
You did?
Yeah. So you need to make sure that your camera is angled so that your whole face is in the frame.
Okay.
So you can just sit up better, or you can angle your camera a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Donna, what you missed was this idea of whether or not the human being in question masters the urges and the thoughts and the feelings and the ego, or if the ego and the urges and the feelings and the thoughts master the human. And now we're not hearing Donna at all. And now you actually are muted within the system and we can't hear you as well. Okay. Sue, Grace, do you have any thoughts about this?
I'm thinking it's a lifelong struggle, like a lion hunt. And sometimes we win and sometimes the lion wins.
And certainly in their desert culture, the lion might be the most fearsome predator they've got. Right. So if you want to have a view of a really, hey, Marilyn, a really fearsome predator who's bigger and stronger than anything else, you're going to choose the lion. And so even though in our culture, we might not be thinking of equating the ego with the lion, maybe it worked for them.
Yeah, that's a helpful way to look at it also.
Okay. Yeah, there's in this particular commentary, the one by Thomas Duffy, he brings in Platonic thought, and he talks about sages and mystics who live for the truth and how they try to tame their ego selves through meditation. And so that's, you know, along with what Jeanette was saying and what we were talking about. Marilyn, we are in stage number 7. We haven't gotten very far. And it is possibly about the ego. That's what we're determining at this point.
My next, oh, that's goal number 2. Oh, we're waiting on the 7. Okay. Okay. Got it.
Okay. So do we want to move on to saying number 8?
Yes.
Okay. Someone with a good sound, would someone with good sound like to read saying number 8?
What is good sound?
Good sound. You, Marilyn, you have good sound. Right now, Jeanette might have good sound, and Donna, we're not sure.
Okay. Have I have sound now?
Donna, yeah. Have sound!
Hey.
Hey.
Oh. All right. Marilyn, were you about to volunteer?
Yes.
Awesome. Do it.
The man is like a wise fisherman who cast his net. Is this the right one?
Yes, it is.
Cast his net into the sea and drew it up from the sea full of small fish. Among them, the wise fisherman found a fine large fish. He threw all the small fish back into the sea and chose the large fish without difficulty. Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear.
Okay, let's let that sink in for a moment or two in silence. What do you think of saying number 8?
Let the little guys grow up and you'll get a big fish someday.
Yeah, that's fair.
Put them back and take the big one.
You have to have an understanding of what you're looking for, I think, and know that a bunch of small fish aren't going to provide you with very much. Whereas a large one will have a lot more meat to it.
Yeah, very practical. Jeanette?
The book that I'm reading, one that you recommended, the big fish is now being the capital B. That is one's central being.
Okay, Jeanette, I'm going to stop you again. Okay. We can hear you when you look at the camera. We can hear those words.
Self-knowledge. Can you hear me?
Now we can hear you.
Our knowledge of being with a capital B. It is to maintain the presence, capital P, of the one, capital O, in the midst of multiplicity. This, by the way, this booklet I'm using that Sarah Liz recommended, it's very Gnostic oriented. And so this being with a capital B, according to the Gnostics, is an uncreated, everlasting being. So they believe it's, you know, it's your essence, your being. It had no beginning and has no end, which is quite radically different from our typical Christianity.
It's different, but I wouldn't call it radically different, because I think that the Gnostics would argue that being is seated in God, mm-hmm. and it is in and through and with and of God. Mm-hmm. And so then we start splitting hairs about when was the beginning of beingness. And the Gnostics are like, yeah, you're still thinking in terms of time. Stop thinking in terms of time. Time is a linear process, and it's part of this horrible world. God is outside of time. And so being is outside of time. And so being and God are one and together and outside of time. And having a party over there outside of time.
And God is with us and in us, and we are in him and with him. Mm-hmm. And So there isn't a separation.
Right. And if you take some of the things that Jesus says, especially in the Gospel of John, really very literally about how Jesus is with God and in God and of God and from God. And if you just look at it, he's kind of using every preposition that the Greek language has. Mm-hmm. To try to describe a kind of all-consuming withness that is very much what some of the Greek philosophers were also poking at and trying to think about and understand and describe and suppose. And so it depends on what you want to focus on. And if you are a Christian who wants to focus on their divine connection and their oneness with God, then it all starts to sound very familiar and very similar. But if you're a Christian who wants to really focus on this outside world of things and stuff and trees and rivers and individual people, then the idea of oneness doesn't really fit, if that makes sense. And so it depends on what you focus on as kind of what is the deepest truth that you can understand in this life. And you know, it's different for every one of us, and that's okay. That is okay. Mm-hmm. In my version here, I'm using primarily the Jean Yves Leloup version that I'm reading out of. That's the one. It also cross-references in several portions of Matthew, a couple of portions of Luke, a portion of John, and a portion of Romans, interestingly, that are very similar to this text. And you might remember some of them just off the top of your head, because Jesus was telling stories about what the kingdom of heaven was like. And the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant who finds a pearl beyond price. And then the merchant goes and sells everything he has to be able to purchase that one pearl beyond price. And that's very like this story with all the little fishies and the one big fish. And someone found a treasure in a field and they sold everything they had to go buy the field so that they could have the treasure. And again, you hear a similarity, this idea of very easily giving up all the little things of life in order to chase after that and hold and take hold of that one valuable thing. Now, this might not actually work in your own life if you try to transpose it directly without thinking about it kind of metaphorically. Like, I would not sell all the books in my library just because I found that one beautiful first edition of some ancient manuscript that cost $10,000. Because for me, the manuscript is not the end all be all, but in my own spiritual quest to become closer and closer to God, let us say I have read a lot of books. I have read a lot of books. And I have read a lot of New Age stuff, stuff you might roll your eyes at. I've read a lot of ancient stuff, stuff you might be like, really? You read that? Oh, yes, I read that. And I feel like I have been sifting through a lot of little fish, metaphorically speaking, to find the one big fish. And having found it, I feel like I can let go of all the little fish. I don't need to read all of the crazy and the latest New Age stuff. I don't need to read extensively all of the ancient texts. Well, they're interesting, sure, but they're a little distracting. Because I found the one thing that makes perfect sense to me and that explains to me my own relationship with God and my own relationship with Jesus and where I want to take my life. And so I feel very much like I have had that moment of fishing and pulling up the net and finding all the little fishies and thinking, you know, none of these are quite finished growing yet, but I'm going to take that big fish because that's going to satisfy me. That's going to feed me in the way I need to be fed. So, you know. Another, don't go sell all your possessions just to get one really good one. That's not the goal here.
I think one more thing it's saying too is that we don't need to hang on to every good thing that comes our way. We should be willing to part with some things, and some of us find it very difficult to part with things.
Yeah.
I think that's
yeah. It's funny because it's all situational, isn't it? I mean, I remember someone who really struggled with perfectionism, which is not my own personal problem. Bless you if that's yours. I don't understand how your brain works, but I love you a lot. So I had this friend in seminary who really struggled with perfectionism. And one of her advisors gave her the mantra, "The best is the enemy of the good." And that really helped her to let go of this perfectionist tendency that she couldn't possibly finish until it was absolutely perfect to kind of an unhealthy degree. And that good enough was good enough, which was her second mantra that she also really liked. Good enough is good enough. But you know, for other people, that wouldn't be a helpful mantra. For people who are low achievers, who barely come up to snuff, good enough is not good enough. Come on, strive a little harder, friend. So it's, you know, it's all situational. It's what is the advice that we need to hear in our specific lives? Good enough is good enough. It still haunts me sometimes.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like mediocrity, which mm-hmm. might not get you to your end goal.
Right. But if you are a workaholic and a perfectionist, yes. It is the thing that will let you sleep at night.
Yes. so that you can keep digging.
Right. So that tomorrow you can wake up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and begin again to overwork yourself into an early death. Right. So, you know, it's, we human beings really do come out very different one from another sometimes.
And interestingly, we also are such a composite of universal truths. I mean, we're all so much alike sometimes that it's equally mind-boggling.
Yeah. All right. Does anyone else have an observation or a thought about saying number 8? Right. Let's move on. Would someone like to read out saying number 9?
I can read it now that I have audio.
Okay, Donna's going to do it.
The parable of the sower. Jesus said, look, a sower went out, took a handful of seeds and scattered them. Some fell on the roadside. The birds came and gathered them. Others fell on the rock. They didn't take root in the soil, and ears of grain didn't rise toward heaven. Yet others fell on thorns. They choked the seeds, and worms ate them. Finally, others fell on good soil. It produced fruit up toward heaven, some 60 times as much, and some 120.
All right, let's let that sink in for a moment in quiet. All right. What do you think of saying number 9?
We don't all hear the same identical words the same way. We don't see all the same action the same way.
Yeah. And the parable of the sower should sound pretty familiar to most of you.
Yeah. It's like, I appeal the word of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And because, how you put it to use.
Right, right. And we've heard it in Mark, Luke, and Matthew. It's very similarly worded. I heard an interpretation of this, and it was, you know, it was one of the gospel versions, but it was a beautiful interpretation of this. And it was by a New Zealand woman who's a poet named Joy Cowley. And I probably have that interpretation somewhere behind my left ear, but I'm not gonna go look for it right now. But the name of her poem was The Sower Keeps on Sowing. And I always found that beautiful and fascinating, because reading this passage and reading the parables from the gospels, at least the synoptic gospels, I can get all tangled up in the minutiae of, oh, well, you know, that person over there was thorns and that person over there was the road. And I can get all tangled up in judging other people and wondering, was I good soil? I bet I wasn't good soil. I bet I was the rocky bits. I got to work on this. I want to be good soil. Okay. But the poem points out that the sower keeps sowing. And the sower sows indiscriminately. And that it feels like God's love that God gives to everybody. And some places it takes root real well. And other places it grows up but is destroyed in a day. And that provides eventual compost for good soil. And sometimes it feeds the birds. And sometimes it's choked out by weeds. But the sower keeps sowing. And the sower's never actually going to stop. And that looking at God's actions in the parable, sometimes gives me great peace when I'm feeling judgmental about myself and the world.
Yeah, that's the most hopeful interpretation I've ever heard. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say it's a very optimistic notion connected to it rather than the pessimism of, you know, failure in the one in the areas that don't produce.
If I find it afterwards, I will type it up and email it to y'all.
There are all levels of good soil, too. You can have pretty good soil, and you can have excellent soil, and still good.
Yeah. Yeah. And the sower will keep
soil, cared for soil, as and just good but neglected. Mm-hmm.
And you do see a lot of very interesting, lovely plants growing up among the rocks. So it's possible anywhere. And as you were talking about never always plant, always planting, replanting the source and sowing, I was thinking, well, the Holy Spirit is often pictured as wind that blows the seeds. Blows the seeds where they need to be so that they'll grow. So there's always hope.
Right. And, you know, I grew up in suburbia. And so when I grew up, I loved dandelions. And I was surrounded by adults who thought they were evil. Because I grew up in suburbia. And y'all know how suburbia is. They want those beautiful green lawns that you can putt on. And it's just not the same if there are dandelions in it. And, you know, since then I've lived in a variety of places, and I now understand that you can eat dandelion leaves in a salad, and you can make wine out of those tiny, tiny, tiny little yellow petals. If you are very fastidious and have a lot of patience, you can make wine out of those tiny, tiny petals. But then I also learned that the taproot of the dandelion brings nutrients up to the top of the soil that other flowers can't have access to without dandelions there. And it's because the dandelion's root can reach down deeper than most of the other flowers around them. And so a dandelion will actually help to recirculate nutrients and bring up deeper ones back up to the top of the soil. And you know, some people still think it's a weed. Some people still are happy to put toxins into their lawns in order to kill the dandelions, but it's all perspective.
You would like where I am at this moment. I'm in Connecticut, and my son and daughter-in-law do not use pesticides. And this morning, the lawn person called and is coming to mow, but will be sure to leave 6 inches along the border so the dandelions will grow, because birds are eating them, and we have to feed our birds.
Right. Any other thoughts on saying number 9? It's a very familiar one to Christians who hear the Bible read regularly or read it themselves. Okay, let's move on to saying number 10. Would anyone like to read out saying number 10 for us?
I'll read it.
Okay, Grace, do it.
Jesus said, "I cast fire on the world, and look, I'm watching over it until it blazes."
All right. Nope, that's it. That's it. That's all that is saying number 10. So let's stop there and let that sink in for just a moment. What do you make of saying number 10?
Well, he's talking
more explicit
about he's casting his word over the world and waiting for it to raise and people to accept his word.
That's one interpretation, yes. What do you guys make of it?
Well, you get warmth from a fire as you sit there and watch it come into a blaze.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette, what are you going to say?
Can you hear me? The book I'm using.
Now we can, go on.
Interpret the flames as being conscious love taught and revealed by Christ. And I like that interpretation of the blaze.
I think it's a fire can be very good, but it has to be guarded.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Christ has seen the blaze?
I'm sorry? What was that, Donna?
Jesus said, I've cast fire on the world and look, I'm watching over it until it blazes. Do you think Christ has seen the blaze?
I don't know. What do you think?
I kind of don't think so. I kind of don't think so when I see the word of the Lord not being internalized and accepted in the majority of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Population. Did it ever blaze?
I think it's a little bit relative. It's probably sizzling a little bit, at least, throughout the world. It's not a roaring fire. It has ended, and that's what the Avion says. He's tending it.
Do you think it will ever blaze?
In some people and in some places, sure. But not.
I live in hope.
Yes.
Yes. One day it will blaze and I probably won't live to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't do everything I can in my own life.
Right.
To be a little bonfire.
I guess what brings it to mind is that the state of the Christian church these days.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing the battle for people's hearts.
Yes. But there's
that's what I thought. Well, did it ever blaze? There was a time where Christianity, I guess, was considerably stronger in people's lives than it is today. And then what happens if Christianity blazes, then what happens to other religions? If they, the Buddhism and the Jews and the Judaism and where does are those? I don't know. I guess I'm going too far with this.
That's a perfectly reasonable place to go. Jeanette, do you want to jump in with a comment here?
Yes, I think that what's important, God is love. It's not what religion you are. But for example, I think that it's blazing in certain places. For example, just recently in some of the activity taking place among different nations to support the Ukrainian people. I mean, that meeting that Biden got together with nations from all over the world. I mean, I think that was a blazing of the fire. You know, it wasn't just NATO. I mean, these are nations, Japan, and I mean, a lot of countries that don't belong to NATO. I mean, they met, what was it, a couple of days ago in Germany, you know, to again, foster a concerted support of the Ukrainians. And that's a blazing fire. And I don't really think that the fire depends on what religion you are. God is love, and there's not just one path to, God.
Right. And you know, and addressing the question of religion, it really, it's a matter of interpretation. Do we think Jesus was trying to sow a fire in the world about a change in people's hearts? Or do we think Jesus was focusing on founding a new religion, and it was the religion that was the fire, and if you were out of the new religion, then it doesn't matter? Sue?
As people were speaking about the other religions, it seems to me that if you were going to build a fire, you would have to have some dry kindling, and it might not all be from exactly the same tree. So your kindling would be just a lot of dry pieces. And if we, in all the different religions of the world, are the kindling, we need to be dry kindling. So we need to try to keep ourselves lined up in what we can learn and what we can think and feel and love one another. And then we'll get the blaze that Jennifer or Jeanette's talking about.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I was really touched in one of the commentaries by a quote, and it's a short quote. And the joy and pain of short quotes is that sometimes they resonate so beautifully. You can just put it on a bumper sticker and everybody gets you. And other times it can be taken so profoundly out of context by people who really deeply don't get it, that it can be used to prove its opposite notion. And the short quote is from Augustine, Augustine, if you prefer, who I typically don't agree with, but I love the short quote. And the short quote is, love and do what you wish. Love and do what you wish. And if you come at that from a place of incredible compassion, and a place of a deep understanding of what love means and who is applicable to this idea of love, that it's for everybody and that it is encompasses everything. So do that. And then whatever else, you know, you need to do in your world, whether you are a baker or a box maker or a teacher or a garbage collector, which doesn't matter. Love. And do what you wish. Because what you wish will never go against love, which comes first. If you come out that with extreme compassion, it makes all kinds of sense. It's like, all right, do we need anything else? That sends everything. And if you come at that with cynicism or a profound dislike of other people or a deep feeling that you're just better than everybody else, it's not gonna be so simple and so clear, or it will be just in the opposite direction. I will love myself and I will do whatever the hell I want. And then you get the totally opposite effect. I'm sorry.
Talking about this, what's going through my mind is the state of so many countries in our world, in Africa, all over the place, where there's, you know, violence and people are killing one another and warlords and tribalism that is so deep that we shoot rockets at each other. You know, one wonders whether love has won the battle or not. That, I guess that's really what, I can't see shooting rockets at one another as an act of love, even though you think you might be right, you know, in whatever the cause is that you're, you know, and it's so, in so many places in our world that that's what's happening. South America and Africa and parts of Europe and, you know, and Asia. That's, I guess, part of the, why I don't see the blaze too. So, right. So maybe I'm just having a really pessimistic day.
Or maybe you've been reading the news.
That's quite possible too. You know? My right. news are going in the wrong direction. And most of the time, I'm a pretty hopeful person, but there are days I watch the news and I really get pretty depressed about what's happening in the state of our
yes.
Being people.
Yeah.
You know? I think that the one thing we have to always remember is that God is love and love is God. That's one. And if what we are asking and talking to him about is truly love, and that's hard because coming from us, it's never 100%, but we like to think that what we're asking, we are asking in love. And I think if God is the love, then we have to be, we have to know that the answer will come from love. And the thing that we have to deal with is the time frame, and that's very difficult because we want the answer in love now, but that just doesn't always happen.
Well, and I look at Jesus's own crucifixion and the brutality of his death and the stark horror that his students went through and the subsequent resurrection. And it's almost as if he's saying, love is the only thing that matters, and not even these bodies matter. So let me prove it to you. Let me teach you this impossible lesson to learn, and you're not going to get it, and that's okay. And it's not about the bodies. Because the outrage that makes us want to pick up a rocket isn't just a sense of my tribe is better than your tribe. It's a deep remembered visceral thing about what your tribe did to my tribe. Mm-hmm. And largely forgetting what my tribe did to your tribe. And when you boil it all down, it's how many bodies were hurt. And if, like most of humanity, you equate yourself, your immortal self, with your physical decaying body, as, you know, most of us do, if we're not enlightened, then yeah, you punch me in the face, I'm gonna get mad at you. And I might knock you in the knees. But what if I didn't actually care about my body? What if you punch me in the face and I understand so much why you did that, and I don't actually think that my immortal self is this body or this face. And all I can do is love you because I see that that punch was a cry for love. And so the only proper response for a cry for love is love. And so if I don't actually see that bodies are important, which again, flies in the face of all common sense. But if I don't think that bodies are important, and I really think that bodies are just tools for communication, and the only communication there really is, it all boils down to an expression of love or a cry for love, then the only proper response is love. Because if you express love to me, then I will return love to you. And if you cry for love for me, I will return love to you. And if, and we've got a long statement, we've got a long string of if statements here, friends. If this was something like what Jesus espoused, that it wasn't just an intellectual thought he had, but a deep understanding that he really was with God. That's really who he was and where he was, and that his immortal soul was never in any danger at all, ever, period, the end. You can't convince him otherwise. Then his body is just a tool for communication. And what better way to prove it than to say, okay, they want to kill me horribly? Let's do it. No skin off my nose, metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
And then he came back.
Yeah, the crucifixion is pretty unique situation in the world. It's not like kids being killed in the Ukraine.
Well, and that's the thing. That's where it all seems to break down when we're like, okay, but I do take my body seriously. Okay, but I do think bodies are important. Okay, I may think that about my body, but I'm not going to think that about somebody else's body, and especially not an old frail body or a body in pain or a body of a child or a body of an innocent or a body of a pregnant woman. But it actually breaks down way back when you say, I don't actually think that's true. I don't actually think that bodies are only tools for communication. And if you break off the chain of logic right there, then you break off the chain of logic right there. And you believe something else, and that's up to you. Yes, Sue.
So when you're thinking of your body as something that is basically unnecessary, immaterial, or whatever, not important to you, and then you think about the crucifixion, and I'm thinking of all the things I've been taught in the past 80 years. When Jesus was crucified, I can understand his feeling of, okay, go for it, because I'm with God and this is not me. This is not my end, no matter what you do to me. Mm-hmm. But if it's from the perspective of humanity, which we claim he had, mm-hmm. he suffered, he felt the pain, it was gruesome, it was horrible, and he died. We have a very quiet Saturday in between the celebration of the one, the horror of the one and the celebration of the other. So where does that fit? To think of our bodies as not of being inconsequential.
Well, and I wouldn't say our bodies are inconsequential. I would say that our bodies in this philosophy are tools for communication. And so they are very consequential as tools for communication. But what they are not is our egoic selves, in the small e egoic sense, that way where you identify with a thing, just like human beings are capable of identifying with an object. And so if you take away their objects, they feel as if you have ripped away their own selves. And if their house burns to the ground and they have no more objects, they're not just mourning the fact that they're homeless and they have no place to sleep. They're also mourning that they have lost all of their objects, all of the mementos, all the things that they so strongly associate with who they are. And there's lots and lots and lots of books that aren't necessarily theology books, they're psychology books about how we associate outside objects with our own sense of self.
True.
And so this philosophy says, okay, well, you know how we do that? Well, we also do it this way. We, for better or for worse, associate our body with our sense of self. Now, if you have a perfectly functioning body, there's no problem. But if you are someone who is overweight like me, with a proclivity to overweightness, and all the world tells me that I'm a bad person because I'm overweight, I won't go into all the details, but there are plenty of messages that tell me that. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a person who is getting older and your body is not functioning the way it once did, and you wake up in the morning and think, why won't my back work? or fill in the blank for why doesn't this work anymore? And if you had associated yourself with someone who was powerful and strong and had great mobility and was active and out in the world, what do you do now? Will you have a total crisis? And you see this as a rector, as a priest, when you got to take the keys away from grandma. Because sometimes the kids come to the priest and say, look, we need to take the keys away from grandpa and it's not going well. Could you have a conversation with him? And I've had those conversations, and it's not about driving and it's not about the keys. It's about feeling like that sense of independence is who I am. And if you take away my independence, you will take away a part of my soul. Now, I'm being melodramatic for a reason, because inside, that's what it actually feels like. If you are someone who is really strongly associated your physical independence with who you are. So, people who meditate a lot, people who tend to live in monasteries, do a lot of work to detach from objects and detach from their own sense of self, from ideas like, I am strong, I am independent, that is who I am. And one of the things, one of the pieces of wisdom that comes from ascetic traditions from all religions is that it is possible to detach so completely that you no longer feel as if this body is as important as I always thought it was. The body is the tool for communication. And that is good and right. That is not inconsequential. But if the body begins to break down, I'm not going to take it personally. If people judge me on my body, I'm not going to take it personally. Because this body is just a tool for communication. So going back to Sue's question, what you mentioned is a soup of some biblical passages, but not all the prevalent biblical passages. A lot of medieval theology, a lot of tradition, and if you want to think about it in a therapeutic sense, we have encapsulated those very first students of Jesus, their horror and their pain and their grief and their terror the day after Jesus died. Well, the day of and the day after Jesus died. We have enshrined it. We have perpetuated it through the ages. And we have shot it like a drug into the veins of every Christian. And I feel this as a priest, because I am psychically connected to all Christians. And even though I may espouse to some degree or another this idea that, no, Jesus planned this. This was a teaching. This was a beautiful teaching. We largely misunderstand. I'm trying to understand it. I'm trying to live into that. Good Friday is hell. And it doesn't matter if I'm leading a service. This year, I didn't lead a service. It doesn't matter if I participate in a service. It doesn't matter if I just try to ignore it and do other things. It's like the year after my mother's death, where I thought I was fine and I thought I was fine. And then the actual day, 1 year later of her death, I was a basket case. And I didn't realize why I was a basket case until halfway through the day. I'm like, oh, it's the anniversary of my mother's death. And she only died last year. And she died younger than we think she ought to have. And it was painful and horrible. It's like that on a global scale 2000 years later, we're still marinating in the pain and we can't get out of it. I've been trying for years to get out of it. I don't think I'll be able to get out of it unless I'm defrocked. That's a little bit extreme.
Probably won't work even if you're defrocked.
You're right. It probably won't. So let's
coming from your soul, from your heart, from your inner self. It doesn't matter what the outside trappings are.
So if we take a couple steps back and think, okay, well, is there any biblical basis for anything that Mother Sarah is saying right now? Because maybe she's just making a space cadet, which is fair. If we look at the Gospel of John and his account of the Passion, as opposed to the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we see a different kind of Jesus. We see a Jesus who is calmly in control of his situation. We don't see a Jesus who's freaking out in the garden. Nope. John shows the garden. John shows Jesus in control. We don't see a Jesus who is freaking out on the cross. John shows the cross. John shows a Jesus who's in control. We don't see a Jesus who seems to have lost control of his situation. Like, okay, this is good in theory, but oh, wow, now that I'm in it, it sucks. We see that in the other gospel versions. And one of the tricky things about what should a Christian do when there are three or two or one, well, not just one, four or three or two different versions of seemingly the same moment. And there are perhaps important differences between them. What is a good Christian to do when they hold their Bible open and think, okay, but which way was it? Well, time-honored tradition says you can smush them all together and say, well, John paid attention to this part, and so he only wrote about that part. And Luke paid attention to this part, and so he only wrote about that part. So if we just take all the versions and kind of massage them together, which is sometimes very difficult when they seem to contradict each other exactly, but it's still possible because we're humans and we can smush things. We can smush round pegs into square holes. That's not a problem. We've done that before. So you can smush all the different versions together and say, this is how it worked. Or you can take one version and say, this is the predominant version. This is the one that is largely correct, but we can't discount these other ones. So I'm going to focus on this and then maybe pepper in some details from these other lesser versions. We're gonna shove them in there. That's one, that's another way. Or we can look at all the different versions and say, which one's probably not true? Can we just eliminate one? Okay, that one is probably not true. So we're just gonna ignore it entirely. We're gonna put it over here, we're gonna put a pin in it so we don't forget about it. And maybe we'll read it, you know, once every couple of years. But we really think that these other ones that agree on, you know, most of the important points, that these ones are true, so we'll smush these together. And a tricky bit about this is that when we look at conflicting stories in the Bible, or shall we say not necessarily conflicting, because that's a judgment call, stories that seem to differ on the same subject or the same moment in the Bible. If we take one approach over another, we're going to disagree. We're just going to disagree. And if we look at just one and say, well, that one's my favorite, that one's the thing that the one that I actually think was kind of true, and we stop looking at the others, not only are we going to disagree, but we're going to really piss people off. And the deepest difficulty is, no one was actually there to tell us what really happened. Jeanette,
I think the important thing is, in each of the books of the Bible, the author had a certain message they wanted to get across. And the way it was written is dependent on their message. And so, you know, there's no disagreement. You can equally value and trust all of the books of the Bible. But what you need to think about is, why is John emphasizing or taking a certain perspective versus, you know, Matthew or Mark, who is emphasizing and maybe taking a different perspective? So I think that's the important thing. What's the message? What are they trying to emphasize?
And that is another beautiful way to interpret. And it's a very popular one right now in this kind of postmodern age. You know, what was Matthew's point of view? Who was he trying to convince? What would be convincing to the people that he was listening to? What did he perhaps massage in that way? And it's kind of like, you know, if you're talking to your best friend and you know your best friend has certain prejudices and certain preferences, and they're telling you a story about what happened when they were on the phone with their sister, and you can take their story with just one or two grains of salt because you know your best friend and you know their prejudices and you know their preferences and you know their sister is not actually walking evil. And you know, they've had a disagreement again. And you can think, okay, the truth is probably somewhere close to what my friend is saying, but, you know, maybe a little closer to her sister. Maybe her sister didn't just really ruin her life this time. It can be a little bit like that. It's tricky, though, when we read it and just expect it to make perfect literal sense to us 2,000 years later in a different culture, in a different time with different expectations. That gets tricky. Marilyn, what do you want to say?
It just reminds me that when two people are looking at the exact same thing at the same time, and they both tell their version, both versions are true for that person, or for each person. It's not that one is true and one is not. It's the way that the two different people see things, and they're both very true. And I think we have to remember that, that somebody is not lying or making it up or anything. It's just really the way that they see it and report it.
Right. And on that note, we end our crazy, far-reaching, and fabulous discussion of the week. Thank you very much for coming.
I just want to say, I had a friend who lost her house in a fire, and it was a house that was full of what we would consider to be treasures and books that her husband had written, and just all kinds of wonderful things. And she said, as dreadful as it was, and how horrible, and how sad, and how everything bad, she said, it's unbelievable freeing to lose all of that stuff.
Yep. And some people do think that. They're in the minority, usually. But some people say, you know what? I've let it go and I feel better. Thank you for joining us this week. I'll see you next week at the same time. And I hope you have a lovely end of April. And I hope that it's not snowing wherever you are.
Amen.
All right. We saw a few flakes this morning, but they didn't last.
All right. Bye, friends. I'll see you next week.
I came to my house.
Thank you.